I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The Democratic presidential campaign once had 24 candidates. Now it has two, Senator Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden. Sanders told reporters this week at a press conference in Burlington that there are significant differences between his campaign priorities and those of the Biden campaign.
What this campaign, I think, is increasingly about is which side are you on? Our campaign is unprecedented because there has never been a campaign in recent history that has taken on the entire corporate establishment. And I'm talking about Wall Street, and I'm talking about the insurance companies and the drug companies and the fossil fuel industry. And that is an establishment which is working frantically to try to defeat us.
In many respects, this primary contest seems to be a fight to determine the heart and soul of the Democratic Party as it pits the more moderate wing of the party against a more progressive wing. And today in the program, we're going to take a look at the changing dynamics of this Democratic race. With us today, former Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Zach Montalero, who is a national campaign reporter at Politico, and Jenna Johnson, who is a national political correspondent at The Washington Post. Great to have you all with us today. We really appreciate you taking the time to be on the program.
Of course.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to start off with all three of you of what a difference a week can make, even a day in some of these cases. But if we were having this conversation exactly a week ago, we would be looking at a very, very different situation. Last Friday, the national pundits and the Biden said the Biden campaign was on life support and that a poor showing in South Carolina would doom his candidacy. At the same time, Bernie Sanders was looking more and more like the presumptive Democratic candidate, and that possibility was sending shockwaves through some of the moderate leaders of the party. Well, then we saw Biden winning big in South Carolina, doing very well on Super Tuesday. Now he appears to be the front runner. Eric Davis, I think a lot of people are scratching their heads and wondering, what has happened in this race? Did South Carolina really propel Joe Biden into the front runner status?
It wasn't just the victory in South Carolina. As Jenna and some of her colleagues in the Washington Post noted in an article published a day or two ago, the South Carolina victory changed the dynamic among the thinking of the other candidates. Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar before Super Tuesday, and Michael Bloomberg right after Super Tuesday. All three of those campaigns came to the conclusion that they weren't going to be able to win enough delegates to get the nomination. And they were all very concerned about the possibility of Bernie Sanders becoming the nominee and then losing to President Trump in the fall. So you had this event. I think the most significant event in the last week was the event in Texas, where Biden was endorsed by Beto O'Rourke, another former candidate. Pete Buttigieg endorsed him. Amy Klobuchar on the same day endorsed him. And I think that sent a signal to voters in the Democratic Party, other than those who considered themselves the most progressive, the most liberal, that they should get behind Joe Biden. And then the Super Tuesday results showed that Bloomberg, in spite of spending $500 million, was going nowhere. So he dropped out very quickly.
Jenna, this has to be one of the most remarkable comebacks in U.S. political history. Why do you think it happened?
It really is, and I'm sure Zach will back me up in saying this. It's been an exhausting week. I mean, it has just been one development after another, one change after another. What seemed to happen here was, as the results were coming in from South Carolina, candidates were looking at each other and realizing that there just wasn't a path forward for them. And that's something that we didn't see happen in 2016 on the Republican side. You saw a lot of Republican candidates stay in the race as long as they could, just thinking that maybe they would take fire or, you know, catch fire and pick up and beat Trump. But, you know, these candidates just looked at what was happening, and Biden suddenly became a strong candidate. You know, his South Carolina win wasn't a narrow win. It was a very strong win, and it showed that he had very strong support from Black voters, from suburban voters, from women voters, from rural voters, and had strength in ways that some of these other candidates did not. And I mean, there were a lot of conspiracy theories that there must have been some big hand kind of playing puppeteer with all of this. But in talking with the candidates and in talking with their campaigns, I mean, they say they just looked at the reality and they didn't see a path forward and decided to get out. And not only that, decided to get behind Biden and strengthen him even more.
Zach, what are your thoughts? Are you surprised that the Biden campaign has taken off in such a short period of time?
Well, it's kind of a cop-out, but yes and no. Look at the states that voted on Super Tuesday versus look at the states that voted before it. One of those states was in the South before Super Tuesday, South Carolina. And look at where Vice President Biden's strength comes from, the South. You know, he cleaned up in Alabama, in Arkansas, in Oklahoma, in, you know, North Carolina and Virginia. And he, you know, challenged Senator Sanders in Texas. So the Biden campaign has argued all along, just get me to South Carolina. I swear I'm still in this race. Get me into South Carolina. And it turns out once southern states started voting, they voted overwhelmingly for the former vice president. But that's not the only part of his strength on Super Tuesday. You know, it was the big southern win was a given when Mike Bloomberg kind of fell apart. It's look how good he did in states like Massachusetts and Minnesota and even in Vermont. The fact that former Vice President Biden broke 15% in Vermont was a big surprise for me, and that he won Massachusetts and won Minnesota. You know, so it's a combination of it was states favorable to him finally had their chance to vote, and then the backing of Pete Buttigieg, the backing of Amy Klobuchar, of all the moderates kind of swarming to Vice President Biden, that's what put him over everywhere else.
Bernie Sanders has set all kinds of records with his fundraising this year. Just last month, he raised $46 million. Several million people have now contributed to the Sanders campaign. The average contribution is roughly $18. There are folks that have given 10 and 20 times in very small amounts. We've even heard of cases where someone sends Bernie Sanders $5 every other day. That's their contribution. That's their attachment to this campaign. And Sanders says there's a big difference in the way that he raises money and how the Biden campaign raises money, and that this difference is reflected in their political philosophies.
So what does it mean when you have a campaign which is funded very significantly by the wealthy and the powerful? Does anyone seriously believe that a president backed by the corporate world is going to bring about the changes in this country that working families and the middle class and lower income people desperately need?
Jenna, how much of an issue do you think this is with voters, where these candidates get their money?
Voters definitely care about this, and they do not like the role that money plays in politics. With that said, a lot of voters also just want to beat President Trump in November, and they know that money is going to be part of that. Sanders still has a very strong movement around him. Small dollar donations from people, people showing up to these big rallies that he throws. He has a very, very dedicated following. And for those people, the money is a big deal. They want to get behind a candidate who they're funding, who's not being funded by super PACs or big donors and things like that. There are just such stark differences between Biden and Sanders. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's going to be one Democratic nominee. And the big question is, you know, no matter which one of these two it is, it's going to be difficult for them to get the other supporters to rally behind them. And in the weeks ahead, as these two are battling it out for the nomination, it'll be interesting to watch if there's still things that they're doing to try not to completely turn off the supporters of their opponent.
Zach, that's really the question. The one that Jenna raises is when this is all and said and done, and who knows when it is, April, May, because Bernie Sanders certainly has the grassroots fundraising to stay in this race for a long, long time. But the question is, when it's finally decided, will let's say Bernie Sanders wins the nomination, has a majority of delegates, will the Biden people be able to support Bernie Sanders and vice versa? If Joe Biden is the nominee, will the Sanders campaign and will the Sanders supporters feel, hey, here we go again. It's 2016. You know, that election was rigged and this one is too.
Yeah, that's the big question in every election. What we do know, at least if we can look at 2016 when Sanders, you know, ran against Hillary Clinton, the majority of Sanders supporters will turn out for the nominee and presumably vice versa, that majority of Biden supporters would turn out for Sanders. It's on the margins where it matters. That when there was three major states decided by a collective 77,000 votes, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan in 2016, 10% of someone's supporters not showing up is a big deal. You know, most Democrats will show up and vote for whoever the nominee is. They want to beat Donald Trump first and foremost. But it's making sure that extra bump, that extra 5 to 10 to 15% of the supporters who may not be inclined to show up for somebody who's not their candidate actually do show up. And we've kind of seen Senator Sanders kind of make headway and try to open the tent of his coalition a little bit. You know, interestingly enough, he's running an ad down in Florida right now highlighting President Obama praising him. That's a different song than Senator Sanders has sang both publicly, you know, and on the campaign trail, that he's not hesitated to criticize President Obama when he feels he needs to be criticized. But now with the race, you know, coming down to functionally two candidates, Senator Sanders realizes and his campaign team realizes that, hey, we can't just win off our base alone. We need to reach out to people across the Democratic coalition. And we're starting to see that more and more from both sides.
Eric, I wonder, in 2016, I think it was projected that between 5 and 10% of Bernie Sanders supporters actually voted for Donald Trump in the November election. Is 2020 different because in 2016, they might not have known what they were getting themselves into with Donald Trump, but now they sure do?
That is certainly true. And one of the states where there's some evidence that that happened, Sanders supporters in the primary, then voting for Trump in November, was Michigan. And Michigan is the next important state to have a primary next Tuesday. And I am very interested to see how Sanders is going to do in Michigan this time around. If we look at the states other than Vermont that he won on Super Tuesday, in all of them he got in the mid-30% range of the vote. That's Utah and Colorado and California and so forth. And to win Michigan, obviously, in a two-person race, you need more than 50%. And now that it's only basically two candidates, the delegates are going to be allocated just about in the same proportion as the vote. Can Sanders win more than half the vote in Michigan? I think he faces some challenges. We've seen that African-American voters are strongly in Joe Biden's camp. The large African-American population in Detroit, that's going to be a challenge for Sanders. But the most important constituency for me in Michigan is going to be the white workers without college degrees, people who live in the Detroit suburbs and some of the smaller cities like Flint and Bay City, Midland, Saginaw, and so forth. And how's Bernie Sanders going to do with the white workers without college degrees? Those are the people who put put Trump over the top in Michigan in November 2016. And if a Democrat wants to win Michigan in 2016, that's a constituency they need. And I think at this point, Biden may have an edge among that constituency. We'll know when the results come in next Tuesday night.
Let's go to our callers and start off today with Donna, who is calling from South Burlington. Hi, Donna. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Well, I'm one of those people who couldn't decide between Klobuchar and Buttigieg and Bloomberg. So where's that put me now? Well, I think I sort of have to go with Biden at this point. And the reason is that I really think that you have to be realistic about what's possible to do in 4 years. And I don't like the way Sanders has kind of I think, misled a lot of young people into thinking that Medicare for all means free health care. You know, I'm looking at Medicare myself in the very near future, and it's not really going to cost me that much less than I was paying under the Affordable Care Act. You know, so people who think they're going to get free education and free this and free that, I think they're, you know, it's a very easy thing to say, but as, you know, Pete and Amy were pointing out, it's not the facts. It's not what's possible. So, you know, I'd like to understand more about why there's so little honesty about what Medicare for All really looks like.
Donna, that's a great point. Jenna, I wonder if this is a fair comparison. It seems like when Elizabeth Warren was asked about health care, when she finally came through and had a financing plan, I think we could start to see her popularity starting to go down. Bernie Sanders has been able to say, you know, we'll figure it out. You're not going to end up paying more than you pay now. The United States spends twice as much on health care as any other country in the world. Of course we can afford it. But he has really not mentioned the very specific taxes that would be needed to pay for it. Does that start to hurt Sanders?
I think it already is. If you've been watching some of the last debates, this is the one thing that the moderate candidates were just beating him on again and again and again. How are you going to pay for this? Where is this money going to come from? And Senator Sanders, up until this point, has kind of had this answer of what he's calling for is such radical, sweeping change that's going to just transform how we do things in this country. And so, yes, this is going to be expensive, but we're also going to be doing other things that are going to offset that. And until these changes get underway, it's difficult to see where everything's going to move around to. You know, that's a difficult answer for some voters to believe, just like Donna was saying in her call. And, you know, exactly, we saw Elizabeth Warren kind of tie herself up in knots on this issue. You know, it's easy to come out with a big idea, but then when you get into the fine details of how that would actually be executed and funded, and you have other candidates questioning that and attacking that, you know, there are a lot of, it seems like there are a lot of things that these candidates did not agree on. If you take the very big picture look, I mean, these are Democrats running for the Democratic nomination. They actually agree on the big issues in a very meaningful way. But healthcare was one where there were differences. And in debates, in media coverage, in comments on the campaign trail, there was just a big spotlight on this issue. And I think it's one that, you know, voters have learned a lot about and have hit the point where they're able to raise questions of their own.
Let's talk to Richard, who's calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob. Yeah, I'm a big Bernie supporter, and I'm going to be one of those people, if he doesn't get the nomination, it's going to have to bite my tongue and vote for Biden. And the main reason is that the judiciary, especially the appellate court, Supreme Court, especially, he could have maybe two more appointments to the Supreme Court, and that would last those people. And the ones that are appointed now, they're fairly young. You're talking 20 or 30 years, possibly, on the Supreme Court. And all I can say is I hope Joe Biden, he seems to be, his mind, he's getting a little forgetfulness and confused. I just hope he has the druthers, and I don't know if he has dementia or what, but it's scary if he has to debate Trump if he gets the nomination. Thank you.
All right, Richard, thanks very much for your comments. Let's talk to John, calling from Stratford, Vermont. Hi, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Bob. Hey, I was Democratic chair in my town for over 20 years, and I voted in the Republican primary. This election, I voted for William Weld because it gave me a chance. It's given me a chance to vote twice against Donald Trump. I don't think there's any question that people will come together to oppose this man who who can only think that what he says is true, has no sense of our Constitution and the checks and balances provided in it. And I think come the general election, no matter who the candidate is opposing him, everybody's going to come together and vote against him.
Okay, John, thanks very much for your phone call. Well, certainly we've been talking about some of the differences on issues. Healthcare was one of them, with Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan versus an expansion of the Affordable Care Act and a public Medicare option that Joe Biden supports. Sanders has opposed free trade agreements. He's starting to criticize Biden very heavily for supporting things like NAFTA. Sanders is also pointing out Biden's vote in favor of the Iraq War, Biden's sponsorship of a major crime bill in the 1990s, and Bernie said this week that he plans to focus on many of these issues.
Joe and I have a very different voting record. Joe and I have a very different vision for the future of this country, and Joe and I are running very different campaigns. And my hope is that in the coming months, we will be able to debate and discuss the very significant differences that we have.
Eric, how serious are these differences? And are we going to see a period now of in the next couple of weeks where Biden and Sanders really go at each other?
Well, we might very well. The next debate, DNC debate, is scheduled for a week from Sunday, the 15th, from Phoenix. And that'll be just a two-person debate between Biden and Bernie. And based on Bernie's press conference earlier this week, he looks like he's going to focus the attention mostly on Biden. And I wonder whether that's necessarily the best strategy. Maybe the strategy should be to focus more on Trump. I mean, we had an example of that yesterday. Bernie put out some tweets and some ads attacking Biden for wanting to cut Social Security. Now, it's hard to figure out exactly what the factual basis of those ads is, but apparently it has to do with Biden favoring smaller increases over a longer term when both he and Sanders were in the Senate than Sanders favored. Yesterday, in a town hall, President Trump said explicitly, now granted, it's a Fox News town hall, and he was asked about the budget deficit, and he said, oh, we're going to be cutting Medicare and Social Security. And it seems to me the focus of the Sanders campaign, if he wants to talk about Social Security, should be the need to prevent Trump from having a second term, because Trump has actually come out and says he wants to cut Social Security and Medicare. Biden's never said that.
Zach, Eric mentioned the debate coming up a week from Sunday night. I wonder how important that debate is. It's going to be a one-on-one. Here's Bernie Sanders going up against Joe Biden. Can Joe Biden take care of himself and answer the questions, some of the tough questions that are going to be coming from Bernie Sanders? What's the importance of that debate?
I was for a long time a believer in the debates not having that much of an impact. And then, of course, our minds changed, first with Amy Klobuchar breaking through ahead of the New Hampshire one, and then Elizabeth Warren gutting Mike Bloomberg like a fish, so we shall say, on the debate stage a second time. So this is, and this will be even more important because people are starting to tune in now. This is not your political junkies who are tuning into a debate in, you know, last summer when the field was 26 candidates. This is right in the heart of the primary season, and it's only two candidates on stage. So look, you know, it'll kind of show the different strategies that the two camps will go for. So far, Biden has projected that he will try to keep the focus on Donald Trump, that he will try to, you know, paint himself as a presumptive nominee, that he's going to be trying to speak to a different audience than Senator Sanders will be. And Sanders is going to try to chip away at former Vice President Biden. Senator Sanders has, for a very long time, refused to air negative political ads. And basically all of his campaigns, he doesn't do it. And he's now started to launch one. He launched one that is attacking Joe Biden over Social Security. And that's a major change for Sanders. And it kind of will show how his strategy is going to shift on the debate stage. He's going to probably be aggressive in a one-on-one matchup to try to chip away at Joe Biden in the Democratic primary while he still has that chance.
And Jenna, we hear Joe Biden right now talking about, does this country really want to go down the road of democratic socialism? The country doesn't need a revolution. It needs results. He also talks about Sanders' past links with the governments of Cuba, Nicaragua. Today in the New York Times, there was a story of Bernie's trip as mayor of Burlington in 1988, going over to Russia and the sister city of Burlington, Vermont, and how the Russians hoped to use Sanders in one way or another. How much do these issues present a problem for Sanders?
They very much do. And the fact that a lot of this information has been out there for a long time, and Sanders has been routinely asked about it. But there was a new burst of discussion about this ahead of the South Carolina primary. And I mean, that, you know, that's one of the things that kind of laid some of the groundwork for what we've seen since then. But, you know, with all of the moderate candidates who were once in this race, the thing that you kept hearing from them again and again, you know, was that they worried about having a socialist at the top of the ticket, a democratic socialist at the top of the ticket. And, you know, in getting out and endorsing Joe Biden, one of the reasons that we keep hearing again and again is that they worried not just about Bernie's chances against President Trump in November, but what impact Sanders at the top of the ticket would have on down ballot races, especially as Democrats try to pick up more seats that are held by Republicans. So you have to think that Biden and his surrogates are going to continue to remind people of Sanders and what he represents.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Kyle, who is calling from West Glover. Hey, Kyle, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob and everybody. I have an idea. I kind of feel like the Democrats are in a rush to appoint a candidate because there's a lot of drama between Biden and Bernie. However, I kind of feel like we need to play this like a chess game and not reveal our move until the last possible moment. So my reasoning is that I feel like Trump is a very impulsive and he's a very easily fixated person. He needs a specific target to start tearing down. So I think if the Dems can hold back, relax, like don't destroy ourselves, don't tear each other apart too much, and really hold off on choosing a candidate until the convention as late as possible, it's going to at least force Trump to cut his resources in half on attacking.
And Kyle, what do you think the chances are if the Democrats did extend this primary contest well into May or even June, that they wouldn't end up really attacking each other?
Well, I mean, between you and me, Bob, in the safety of this call, I think the chances are zero. But I hope they would be. I hope they could consider this. Kind of, we've got a very extenuating circumstance right now politically, and I hope that perhaps they could, choose a very extenuating strategy to overcome it.
It'll be fascinating to see if that happens. Kyle, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's talk to Farzine, who is calling from Ascutney. Hi, Farzine. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. I just wanted to say that it looks like everyone is just ganging up against Bernie because Bernie wants to change the establishment, and people don't like to put a candidate who wants to change something as big as an establishment. And I also would like to say that it'll be interesting to see who Elizabeth Warren will go ahead and endorse. Will it be Bernie or will it be Biden?
Farzine, that is a wonderful question. Eric, what do you think? How important is the Warren endorsement to either Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden?
It will be important, but I mean, certainly it will get a lot of coverage from the press. How much influence this endorsement will have, I'm not so sure. I think the one example that we have so far of an endorsement making a big difference was Amy Klobuchar's coming out for Biden, gave Biden her home state of Minnesota. One of the very interesting things about Warren is that while her supporters tend to agree with Sanders on many of the issues, the demographic of the Warren supporters in the primary was very different from the demographic of the Sanders supporters in the primaries, according to exit polls. Warren supporters tended to be older, whiter, somewhat more female, somewhat more highly educated than Democrats as a whole, whereas Sanders supporters were younger, more heavily Latino, had lower average incomes than Democrats as a whole. So I'm not sure if Warren herself comes out for Sanders, all her voters necessarily go with her, or if she comes out for Biden, whether all her voters necessarily go with her.
And Jenna, there was that amazing clip, which I just saw again last night at one of the debates. At the end of the debate, when Elizabeth Warren walks over to Bernie Sanders and says, "Bernie, I think you just called me a liar on national television." This had to do there with a private conversation they said they had to each other, where Elizabeth Warren indicated that Bernie said to her that a woman couldn't be elected president. It was a very tense moment there at the end of that debate. Does that kind of thing kind of linger and might have an influence on who Warren decides to support?
It was definitely a tense moment. An important thing to remember about Elizabeth Warren is that, and this is going to sound cheesy, but her agenda is what really matters more to her. You know, quite often she will talk about not so much the personalities in this race, but just really wanting her agenda to get done and to get implemented. And so when it comes to policy, of course, she's very closely aligned with Senator Sanders in that way. But that incident caused a lot of disagreement between Warren supporters and Sanders supporters. So beyond the two candidates at the top, and who knows what their relationship is right now, there was a lot of nastiness exchanged between their grassroots level supporters and people on Twitter, you know, snakes that were being thrown into tweets and things like that. You know, that's a sort of thing that can keep someone from switching over to Sanders. And also remember, you know, part of Elizabeth Warren's following were a lot of people who had been with Hillary Clinton in 2016. And they have a lot of lingering resentment from that. So, I mean, we'll have to wait and see if she does endorse or not, but I think her supporters are going to be able to figure this out on their own without her telling them.
It seems like a central part of the Sanders campaign strategy has been an effort to turn out millions and millions of people who usually don't vote, young people, middle-aged people. And Sanders was asked at his press conference this week why there haven't been more signs of this big turnout in the first primaries. And this is what he said.
Have we been as successful as I would hope in bringing young people in? And the answer is no. We're making some progress. But historically, everybody knows that young people do not vote in the kind of numbers that older people voted. I think that will change in the general election. But I am honest with you, we have not done as well in bringing young people into the political process. It is not easy.
Zach, this seemed to be just such a central strategy of the Sanders campaign. They talked about it all fall and into the winter. They often talked about how much money they raised in small contributions from folks and how they were going to energize this base of people who usually don't vote and young voters to vote in much greater numbers. But it doesn't seem like it's materialized, has it?
Yeah, you know, we haven't seen that level of turnout, and Senator Sanders is right when he says young people don't vote. That is a tried and true fact in politics. You know, we saw a fairly decent uptick in 2018 for young voters turning out for Democrats in the House elections in 2018, but so far this primary we have not seen a dramatic uptick, a dramatic turnout among young people. It's still, you know, as the older you get, the more likely you are to vote. And that being said, you know, Senator Sanders did find success even without that in some pretty big states, California especially. You know, the biggest prize that Senator Sanders won, and what is frankly keeping him in this race, in the delegate race, is that he was able to put up a pretty comfortable lead in California. Not all the votes are counted there yet. They won't be counted for a while. But Sanders does, you know, even if he's not turning out young people at the level he wants and not turning out disaffected voters, he is reaching some voters in California and some voters in other states like, you know, Nevada, Latino voters especially. So it's not the only piece of his coalition that he has to turn out right now. And Latino voters especially, too, have been a major part of Senator Sanders' success. You know, look at Nevada especially. It's a state he did not do well in 2016, and he vowed not to make that mistake again, basically. and his campaign has invested millions and millions of dollars into turning out voters, you know, Latino voters in California, in Nevada, and across the country, and that's paying real dividends right now. So they're trying to diversify their support as well.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Bob, who's calling from Essex. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Bob. Just a comment and then a question for your guests. It seems to me that come November, the question for most people who will be voting maybe in either for either party will boil down to a question of which is the evil of two lessers. I hate to say that, but anyway. I'm interested in what your guests think about potential vice presidential selections for either Bernie or Biden. And it's probably leaning towards Biden at this point. So it was interesting that Klobuchar's rapid endorsement of Biden following South Carolina, to me, may have indicated some kind of a little quid pro quo there on her part, hoping that she might be the vice presidential candidate. But I'm wondering who else your guests might think might be possible choices, including people we haven't heard about.
Okay, Bob, that's a very good question. Jenna, I know there are people who are looking at both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and saying, we got two 78-year-old guys. One of them is probably going to be at the top of the ticket. Do they really represent the future of the Democratic Party? Any speculation about who either one of them might pick for vice president?
Well, lots and lots of speculation. Both candidates have not really committed to anything or revealed their cards on what they're thinking about potential running mates. But the call from voters is clear that if you're going to have an old white man at the top of the ticket, that there needs to be some sort of diversity coupled with that. And on Monday night, it was like we were almost watching a reality tryout show for who wants to be Joe Biden's running mate. You had, you know, Pete Buttigieg meeting with him and Amy Klobuchar getting up on stage with him and Beto O'Rourke getting on stage and speaking Spanish. Any of the candidates who were already in this race are, you know, definitely people that are going to be considered. Don't forget about Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Julian Castro. And then there are other up-and-coming Democrats across the country who have built followings of their own. On the top of that list, Stacey Abrams, who unsuccessfully ran for governor in Georgia and has been working in states across the country on voting rights issues. So there's a lot of options out there and a lot of speculation about who it might be. But again, that's something that's, still a ways in the future for these candidates.
Definitely. It's interesting to note that in his race against Hillary Clinton in 2016, Bernie Sanders said it would be wrong for the Democratic convention to award the nomination to a candidate who had only received a plurality of votes and not a majority of votes. That could still happen if some other candidates receive some delegates. Now he's saying he sees things a little bit differently. He was asked this week why he feels that a candidate with a plurality, and he's hoping that will be him, why a candidate with a plurality of delegates should be chosen as the party's nominee.
And I just want all of you to think about what it will look like to this country if candidate X, and I don't know who that candidate X might be, I hope it's me, could be somebody else, goes into the convention in Milwaukee with the most votes. And then the party leadership and the insiders and the corporate world say, oh, yes, the people voted for you. You won, you know, a number of states. You've got more votes than your opponent. But we, the corporate world, the insiders, we don't think you're the candidate. And we're going to select candidate Z. I think that would cause massive dismay within the American people.
Zach, could this be one of the Democrats' worst nightmares in that, let's say, neither Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden gets a majority of votes, but Biden has a plurality going into the convention, and the convention chooses Biden, and the Sanders people are going to feel very betrayed?
Yeah, you know, ask me a week ago and I would have had a very different answer. But right now, I really, really, really don't think we're headed towards a contested convention, what happens if nobody gets a majority of delegates. You know, the magic number you need is 1991. That's how many pledged delegates on the first ballot that you need to get to win the nomination. And with right now, with only really two candidates in the race, Tulsi Gabbard is also still running. She has two delegates to her name, probably won't pick up too many more, if any at all. It's a hard thing to see right now, to not see either Sanders or Biden get the majority of delegates. That being said, still a possibility, and that it would be a catastrophe for them. But we haven't had a contested convention since, I think, Dwight Eisenhower, and this at this point with two candidates in the race, not slated to be one again. It was when there were seven candidates in the race and it looked like nobody was ready to drop out, that was a very real possibility. But the fact that everybody exited the field, with the exception of Sanders and Biden and Tulsi Gabbard, we're not really going for a contested convention at this point.
Eric, we're almost out of time, but we did get an email from one of our listeners who says, hey, Bernie Sanders isn't really a Democrat. When he's run for re-election in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate in Vermont, he gets the Democratic nomination, but then he turns it down. How much of that is a factor? I heard Joe Biden talking about being a Democrat all his life. I think that was a reference to Sanders.
Yes, and Biden will certainly talk about it over the next month or so. I think more importantly, Democratic candidates for the House and the Senate are concerned about it. There is a concern that if among many of the elected officials in the Democratic Party, that if Sanders ends up as the nominee, the Democrats' chances of winning control of the Senate become more difficult, and they might even face a much tougher fight to hold control of the House than if Joe Biden were the nominee. So I think most House and Senate Democrats would like someone who has won election to the House and Senate as a Democrat, unlike Bernie Sanders, who, as our Vermont listeners know, wins re-election to first the House and now the Senate as an independent.
And Eric, if Bernie Sanders was sitting here, he might say, yes, but the fact that I haven't been a Democrat all my life makes it possible for independents to support me.
Well, it's always possible for independents to support. There are many states that have semi-open primaries where independents can choose on election day, on primary election day, which candidate to vote for. And Bernie Sanders got some votes in a state like that, New Hampshire. So the possibility is always there. I think for Bernie Sanders right now, the most important thing for him is to try and win Michigan next Tuesday, and then do well in Illinois, Ohio, and Florida the week after that.
Well, it's been a great discussion of many of the factors in the Democratic presidential primary race. Many thanks to our guests today, Jenna Johnson, Zach Montalero, and Eric Davis. Thank you all very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, Bob.